Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
We got the contact info that day to Randy DeCommon, who was a produce coordinator for Whole Foods. And we ended up getting a call scheduled with him.
Mm-hmm. It was like a two-minute phone call. He's like, boys, what is this you guys are farming? And we said, Randy, we're growing mushrooms on coffees. He's like, what were you farming before? Like, well, Randy, we're in college. All right, do you guys figure this out? And he's kind of laughing, how to grow mushrooms on coffees. He's like, this is the coolest shit I've ever seen in produce. Boys, figure this out. Call, text me if you need anything else. And then he hangs up.
That was it.
That was it.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how two college grads headed for jobs in banking and consulting decided instead to grow mushrooms and built Back to the Roots, one of the fastest-growing organic gardening brands in the country. One of my favorite things about getting to do this show is we don't just hear about the successful businesses that people built, but also about the businesses they tried to build and ultimately abandoned. Before James Dyson came up with a groundbreaking idea for a new vacuum cleaner, he was desperately trying to market a wheelbarrow that used a giant round ball instead of a wheel in the front. Before Dinah Trout launched Health Aid Kombucha, she was working on an idea to make party kits for adults. Everything you'd need for a roaring 20s party or a Flintstones party. Before Rich Fulop co-founded the bedsheet company Brooklinen, he was thinking about a business selling hot dogs inside hollowed-out French baguettes. And Apoorva Mehta, the guy who started Instacart, was initially convinced he had the perfect business idea, an online social network for lawyers, just for lawyers. I know. Imagine how exciting it would be to connect with other lawyers. Anyway, you get the picture. Sometimes you need to come up with and then try one idea to get to the real idea, which is how the home and garden brand Back to the Roots began. Nikhil Arora and Alejandro Velez originally planned to sell mushrooms, which they grew on used coffee grounds. The idea came from a class they took together at UC Berkeley. And believe it or not, even though neither of them knew much about agriculture or farming, they managed to build a pretty successful small business around it. For several years, they would haul leaky bags of spent coffee grounds from cafes around Berkeley and Oakland to a warehouse they rented near the airport. They grow mushrooms and sell them to the local Whole Foods and a few other specialty food stores. Their guide to farming? Mainly YouTube videos and trial and error. But what's truly remarkable about their business model is that even though it wasn't making a ton of money, it was profitable from the very beginning. Nikhil and Alejandro, who also goes by Alex, would get paid to haul away the used coffee grounds. Then they'd get paid for the mushrooms they grew on those grounds. And after that, they'd sell the nutrient-rich coffee soil that the mushrooms had grown on. But as the co-founders eventually realized, there's only so far you can go with mushrooms and coffee grounds. So eventually, they dropped the mushroom-growing business entirely and moved into the home gardening business, things like seeds and potting soil. And this year, the company says it will reach $100 million in sales, all from an idea to grow mushrooms on coffee grounds. Nikhil Arora grew up in Southern California. His parents were immigrants from India. Alejandro spent his early childhood in Medellin, Colombia, where he experienced firsthand the political violence and terrifying guerrilla attacks that were happening at the time. As a young boy, he and his grandparents were briefly held hostage by the violent Colombian guerrilla group, FARC. But when he was about 11, his mother married an American serviceman, and the family moved to Michigan.
We moved so I'll start off by saying, basically, when I was on the plane, it was like, you're now called Alex. They won't know how to pronounce Alejandro. Mm-hmm. So I basically, as soon as I got to Michigan, I changed my name, didn't speak a word of English, and landed in a town called Paw, Michigan, a town of about 5,500 people. And I was the only Hispanic kid.
So you were an 11-year-old, now named Alex.
Yep.
And put right into a public school right away?
Yep.
And just like sink or swim, like you got to start learning English, basically?
So much so that the day in which I was put in front of the class the first day, and apparently they asked me, where is Columbia? And my teacher, Mrs. Schumann, she brought out, she put me to the front of the class. I was so scared. And then she makes me point to the country where I'm from. And for some odd reason, my like intro is me making gun noises, like gorillas. An 11-year-old from Paw, Michigan, he thought I was talking about gorillas with guns in Colombia. And he's like, whoa, this kid comes from a place where gorillas have guns. That was my intro to my fifth grade class. But the culture in Paw and Midwest culture is so warm. I never felt like I was an outsider.
Hmm. I guess when you were 15, you went to see a doctor because you had a soccer injury, and the doctor discovered a lump in your armpit, which turned out to be stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma. I mean, just I can't even imagine what that must have been like for your mom. What do you remember about that moment and hearing that?
When you mention it, the memory that comes to mind is when the doctor called, and my mom had already gotten the news, and she just turns away, hands me the phone, and I said, hey, doctor, what's going on? And he immediately says, Alex, you have cancer. And as I'm hearing those words, I'm processing my mom take her head and start pounding it against the kitchen wall. And my immediate first question was like, well, am I going to die? And thankfully, the doctor said, no, you're not.
The prognosis is pretty good for that particular kind of cancer, especially when you're 15, but it still meant that you had to go through months of chemotherapy, right?
Yeah. I went through 4 cycles of chemo.
And did you lose your hair?
I did, yeah. I mean, I was the luckiest immigrant to have come to a town like Paw. The entire town rallied around me. So the entire basketball team shaved their head. And then
wow,
the entire school started shaving their head. I had another friend of mine, Mackenzie, who did prayer chains. So the entire school did prayer chains, and she glued one by one and created a whole chain. And she took to the day-long chemotherapy sessions. Though just a lot of love around me.
Mm. All right, let's pause. And I want to move to you, Nikhil. You grew up in Orange County, right?
That's right. Grew up born in Irvine.
And were your parents, did they have a lot of friends in the Indian community? Also, like people who had immigrated to the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a huge part of my experience growing up was just, and I've realized this more as I've been older, just how incredible it is and the amount of, and you even think about entrepreneurship, like to me, immigrating is the ultimate form of that, of taking risk and sacrifice in search of something better. But, you know, like leaving all of their family, all of their friends back in India to kind of pursue this new journey. And I think what they found in Southern California was the community of a lot of other Indian immigrants who had all done the same thing. And really that all became family for them.
Did your parents have did they push you in any particular direction? Your dad was an engineer. And was there any, did they have any expectations for you or push you in a particular direction?
You know, Guy, they, I know this goes counterintuitive to a lot of the narratives, but they didn't. It wasn't like you have to be a doctor, an engineer. I think they just wanted to see me and my brother working hard, I think that in so many ways too, that, you know, downstream gave me, I think, in the back of my mind, the space, the confidence to keep on exploring new things, which I think that was kind of the energy I grew up with. And I'm just grateful for them for that.
All right, so both you and Alejandro end up going to UC Berkeley for college. I think you started in 2005. Both of you are business administration majors. And senior year, I think that both of you sort of take a class in business ethics, which was like, Nikhil, just briefly tell me what was the class? What was it about?
So it was a business ethics class, Professor Alan Ross. You know, this is a lecture, 100 plus people in this class, which is crazy. We were both in the same classes, both undergrad business majors. And like, we both remember each other in different classes, but somehow never connected, never shook hands, never said hello to each other.
Yep.
And one of the classes, our professor, he's talking about different ideas around sustainability. And this idea gets brought up in one sentence about how you can grow mushrooms on coffee grounds. And he went on to some other topic right after that. And I don't even remember. It was a whole series of different ideas about sustainable business practices, sustainable ideas. And Alex and I both, after class, independently email our professor for more information.
All right. So the professor says, hey, you can grow mushrooms on coffee grounds. Why was that interesting to you? Why did you think that was interesting?
You know, I think I've asked myself that question a lot over these years. And I think for me, it was, you know, just kind of focus on sustainability and recycling. It was all the summers when my grandparents, who had this beautiful garden in a small town, would grow all their own food, and hearing something about growing food. My parents teaching me about kind of just, my dad always in my ear about recycling. And I think all of those experiences over the course of, you know, at that point, 2 decades made that relevant to me at that moment and said, that's really cool, growing food off of waste. And I think going through my mind, I was like, is there something here? This is a really cool idea.
And Alejandro, why were you interested? I mean, when the professor said, "Yeah, you can grow mushrooms on coffee grounds," why did you even pause and reach out to the professor? What did you ask him?
I said, "Hey, that sounds pretty cool. Do you have any more information?" What was interesting is it's kind of crazy, right? Coffee waste has been part of my culture. My grandparents in Colombia had traded coffee. The fact that that sounded like weird magic. Like, how do you take coffee waste and grow mushrooms on it? That's weird, because I loved coffee and I've always loved coffee. So,
all right. So each of you winds up emailing this professor. You do not know each other. You kind of know who the other one is, but you're not friends. He then sends you an email back and says, "Hey, there's another student who emailed me about this, and he connected you guys over email." Is that your memory of what happened?
Yep,
I remember that same thing. He emails the both of us, and the next vivid memory I have, this was, I want to say, February. Alex, it was maybe a month before spring break at that point.
2009,
and we met up at Alex's fraternity, and we just hit it off like right away. And just started kicking around ideas. And honestly, at that point, I think it could have been anything. I think we just, honestly, and this is to this day, is the core of, is we right away realized we just had this connection. And yeah. I think we were bouncing off each other's energy from, and to this day, we still are. But like, I remember just sitting up there and started YouTubing videos. Like the first time, remember that, Alex, we met and we were just, yeah, like started YouTubing how to grow mushrooms and just laughing about all the crazy videos that came up on YouTube and just like trying to figure out, you know, what to do about this whole thing.
And we start realizing, we're like, I think we got to grow this stuff to actually see if it works. And it was like this realization is like, yeah, we got to go and get our hands dirty.
And it was definitely like, I don't know if it was a business per se at that point, guy, but it was like, is there a project? Is there something here? Like, man, there's so much coffee waste out there, and I think turning that into something useful was just, you know, inspiring in that moment.
By the way, why are coffee grounds good for growing mushrooms?
So super rich in cellulose. The cellulose structure of coffee grounds mimics that of, you know, a tree on which oyster mushrooms would traditionally grow. And what's crazy, so the whole reason we started this thing off is that traditionally mushrooms are grown on virgin trees being cut down for their logs, mainly overseas, as a substrate to grow mushrooms. And when we first heard this fact, we're like, wait, we're importing mushrooms that are grown on virgin trees being cut down just for this substrate when you have this whole massive waste stream, millions and millions of pounds in our local communities, and we could grow this food locally that's what inspired this whole thing. Like, this, that was crazy that people were cutting down trees to grow mushrooms when there was so much agricultural waste and kind of this food waste around to do it. So
got it.
One of the ideas there was like, should we just collect all these coffee grounds and try to sell it to a mushroom farm? And finally, we're like, we should probably just try growing this ourselves, see if it even works.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because like, growing mushrooms is not as lucrative as like mining Bitcoin, right? And I can't imagine there are many mushroom billionaires on planet Earth, but you guys were thinking, hey, this could be an interesting business.
Well, we thought we could have three streams of revenue off of one byproduct. And that was really intriguing.
Which was what?
We could pick up the waste. So we were waste collectors.
Okay. Which is coffee grounds.
Okay. We could sell the fresh mushrooms.
Yep.
And okay. Then third, we could sell the spent mushroom substrate, which is once the mushrooms are done growing, they leave even more nutrients behind.
Ah.
So we're like, oh my gosh, this is a gold mine.
Oh, wow.
This is so cool. Three revenue streams, zero waste on any of this. And then I was an Excel monkey and I pulled out Excel and I modeled it out at this, as Nick Hill's talking. And I said, this could be a big business.
Wow.
And like, that was our first meeting.
I mean, don't get me wrong. By the way, I love mushrooms, but it doesn't sound like you guys loved mushrooms. It doesn't sound like you were like mushroom fanatics.
Nope.
I can't remember eating. I mean, I'm sure we had them on pizza, but that was probably
yeah.
it for both of us.
Not into like sauteed wild mushrooms or anything like that. It just happened to be the thing that was mentioned that then as you looked into it, you thought, hey, you know, you can extract a lot from a mushroom.
Yep. We both, you know, went to the library and found all the mycology books, and over the coming weeks we were YouTubing every possible video on mushrooms and downloading every PDF we could find. And you know, the Paul Stamets, like the mushroom guru who wrote the handbook on growing mushrooms, we got all of his books. And
there's a whole documentary on this guy Paul Stamets.
He's amazing. He's brilliant.
We cold emailed him and he got back to us within 2 hours of us cold emailing him.
You cold emailed Paul Stamets? But for people to know, he's got his whole mushroom tea company, and he's got a TED Talks on mushrooms and documentaries on him. He's like the mushroom kind of expert. What did you email him? Like, what did you ask him?
We were trying to grow mushrooms on coffee grounds, and we were asking him about spawn. And I forget if we asked him directly, Alex. Or we
spawn is like the seed. Basically.
It's like seed, exactly. Yeah, it's analogous to seed. So you need that to get started. So he donated our first spawn or seed that we needed to grow, which eventually we used for our first test buckets.
By the way, you're in Berkeley and you wanted to do this on coffee grounds. Did you just like brew a bunch of coffee and use that?
One local coffee shop and just said, hey, can we pick up your coffee waste?
Yep. The first time we thought we were like afraid. We were like, didn't know how it was going to work. You remember walking into the first cafe and asking for their coffee ground waste and, you know, thinking it's going to be this big deal. And man, they were so happy to get it off their hands. Like, you want to go to the back and pick up that trash bag that's messy and heavy and leaking? Like, sure, go ahead. And I think we're like, oh, okay, there's definitely a lot of this back here and they don't want anything to do with it.
All right. So you get some coffee grounds. Paul Stamets mails you some mushroom spawn, mushroom seeds.
To my fraternity.
To your fraternity house. And what did you get a bunch of like buckets? Like, and just
yep.
White, like imagine white paint buckets. We had about 10 of them. This is right before spring break. And I think finally both of us were like, all right, we just got to do this thing and got to try growing these things. Enough reading, enough watching videos, and decided to plant them. So, you know, we went, collected a bunch of coffee grounds, brought them back to his fraternity, put this tarp down in his fraternity kitchen closet. And we mix in the spawn into them, put a little top on them, poke some holes, trying to use all of our best research, you know, that we had done. And we leave for spring break. And we're both gone for roughly 10 days. And I will never forget this phone call because Alex, you know, gets back to his fraternity. And I get this call and he's just so excited, kind of screaming. He's like, Nick Hill, you got to run up here. You got to check this out. And, you know, I'm in this room with him. We look at these 10 buckets and literally 9 of them are just contaminated, nothing growing, just looking really nasty after sitting for 10 days, you know, with some old coffee grounds. But one of them had this beautiful crop of pearl oyster mushrooms growing out of them. And I remember we were both just standing around this bucket and just looking at it. And, you know, I remember Alex was like, you want to try those? I'm like, I'm not trying these. Like, you want to try them? It's like, I'm not trying these either. We're both kind of, you know, just looking at this bucket of mushrooms sitting in this dark closet.
So did anybody wind up actually sampling the mushrooms?
It was actually funny. That's speaking of, you know, never really being chefs or foodies or, you know, gourmet cooks or anything. Neither one of us was trying those mushrooms, but we were like, what's the best restaurant in town? And we both had heard about this restaurant called Chez Panisse by Chef Alice Waters, who is just an absolute legend and one of the, you know, founders of this entire natural organic food movement with a restaurant right there in Berkeley.
Yep.
We didn't know any of that. We just knew it was this famous restaurant in Berkeley. And we ended up literally walking over this paint bucket, this one paint bucket of mushrooms, walked it over. And she happened to be in the front of a restaurant. She was talking to somebody. And we just walked right up to her and said, hey, Alice, like, I'm Nick Hill. This is Alex. We're trying to grow these mushrooms on coffee grounds. We just grew some. Would you want to try some? And, you know, she got super into it. And she's like, that's really cool. And come to the back with me. And she actually walked us to the back of her restaurant, to the kitchen where her head chef, this guy named Cal, was. And she's like, Cal, do you want to try some of these mushrooms these boys are growing? And he ends up plucking half of the mushrooms out of his bucket. And I remember he chops them up, sautés them up in the back of her restaurant, and she tries them, he tries them, we try them. And I remember Chef Alice Waters was like, man, these are delicious.
Wow. She was on the show a few years ago. And so when you brought the bucket of mushrooms and she said, she kind of gave it her blessing, did they say, yeah, we want to buy them? Or how did you leave it?
No. I mean, we thought that they were going to taste like coffee waste. So yeah. We're like, they're not going to like them. So it was almost like this, okay, this is further along than we thought we'd be. Where do we go from here? So after that, we were like, oh man, now we got a product here. Let's just take it to Whole Foods. And we took the same day, that same bucket, to the Berkeley Whole Foods store. This was at the early days where Whole Foods, you could do this all the time. You know, a lot of local growers would go to a Whole Foods store and on the spot, Whole Foods would buy it from you.
So you guys went to the Whole Foods in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Whole Foods on Telegraph Avenue. Yep. And you like walked in, and who'd you ask for?
First produce guy we saw, his name was Cesar.
And then we just went right up to him and said, we're trying to grow mushrooms on coffee grounds, and we just grew these, check them out, and just kind of told them what we were trying to do. And
Alice Waters loves them.
Now you've got the Alice Waters endorsement, even though it may not have been official, but, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, and he got fired up about it, and he ended up bringing up, he brought his produce manager, I think we had a store marketing lead, about three or four people were, like, huddled around this little bucket of mushrooms, and, you know, we were telling him what we were trying to do and got a bunch of interest and support, and we got the contact info that day to Randy DeCommon, who was a NorCal produce coordinator for Whole Foods, and we ended up getting a call scheduled with him. Alex, must have been, what, a week or two later?
And he said, hey, tell me about what you guys are doing.
Randy's a character. He's like, boys, it was like a two-minute phone call. Boys, I'm seeing all these emails, and what is this you guys are farming? And we said, Randy, we're growing mushrooms on coffees. He's like, you hear this pause, and he's like, okay, what were you farming before? Like, well, Randy, we're in college. Okay. All right. Do you guys figure this out? And he's kind of laughing, how to grow mushrooms on coffee waste. He's like, I'm going to blow you up at Whole Foods. He's like, this is the coolest shit I've ever seen in produce. Take coffee waste, grow mushrooms. Boys, figure this out. Here's my personal cell phone number. So just call, text me if you need anything else. And then he hangs up.
That was it.
That was it.
And no discussion about, like, a purchase order or pricing or anything. It was just like, this sounds cool, but when you figure it out, give me a call back.
It was that. And I think at that point, I mean, we knew nothing about retail. After that phone call, we were now a couple weeks away from graduation. And we were still meeting up all the time, talking all the time, trying to just, like, what are we doing with this? And we heard about a business plan competition called Bears Breaking Boundaries, Big Ideas, it was called at Berkeley. And somehow someone told us about this, Alex. I think it was a night before the deadline. Cause I remember it was an all nighter. We were up to, like, the end of the night submitting this thing right before the deadline. And we learned that we won.
Wow.
No. I think we got second place, brother.
Yeah. It felt like we won this thing. Yeah. We got $5,000 and we were on top of the world. And that is when we, I think, met up. And I remember, you know, very vividly, both of us, and just kind of asking each other, like, if you're in, I'm in, if I'm in, you're in, just kind of both shaking on it and deciding to go all in. And, you know, you fast forward actually to a graduation ceremony, thousands and thousands of kids, right, at Berkeley. And because we'd won this award, our chancellor brought it up in actually his commencement address. And he was like, and we have two kids who are going to be growing mushrooms after they graduate. And I remember the whole like auditorium, this Greek theater, just starts cracking up laughing. And Alex and I look at each other like, what are we getting ourselves into right now? Everyone thinks we're crazy. But that was the start of this whole thing.
Huh. And just to be clear, I mean, before you got going with this mushroom project, I read that both of you had really promising jobs lined up after school ended.
Yeah.
Like Alejandro, I think you were going to go into banking, and Nikhil, you had, I think, a consulting job lined up. And you basically put those jobs on hold, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So how did your parents take the news when you told them that? Like, Alejandro, when you told your mom, who, like, you know, made all these sacrifices to, like, leave Columbia and to get you to the U.S. and you get to Berkeley and you've got this great offer in Wall Street, when you were like, I'm not going to do it. Do you remember what she said?
She was all in.
Wow.
She trusted me. She was all in.
Amazing. She wasn't like, what are you doing? Are you nuts? She was totally supportive.
She was. She saw, and I think probably the best word is how refreshing those 3 months versus my summer experience in investment banking in New York. I had a really tough time. Yet I was going back and signing full time and going back to doing it again. So I think in her eyes, she saw how happy I was, and she just trusted me.
Wow.
Same. And guys, much as we talk about our family being really supportive, we definitely had friends who thought we were crazy. I have this one memory. I remember being on the corner of Telegraph and Durant by the Pete's Coffee there, waiting at like 9:30 or 10 p.m. after closing, and then waiting for Alex to pick me up because he was collecting coffee grounds from some other cafe. And, you know, Friday night, all of our friends are going out and to a party. Like, what are you doing, Nikhil, standing by this trash can with two trash bags? And I feel like Alex almost had an intervention at his fraternity. This, you know, everyone's just like, what are you doing, Alex? You have this job offer, six-figure job offer, you worked your butt off for 4 years, and you're gonna give it up to do what?
Like, what are you doing, man? You just got this job offer you've been wanting to. I've been hearing about you wanting to do this forever, and now you're gonna start growing mushrooms. Like, what are you doing?
That was good advice, but that was good advice that he gave you at the time. I mean, because this was the chances that this was gonna succeed are very, very tiny.
Oh yeah.
So you have $5,000 now. Some money to start. What does that do? What does that get you? What can you do with $5,000 at that point? Summer of 2009, you stay in Berkeley. Everyone goes after their jobs. You guys are staying there. What do you do with $5,000?
We got an $800 van.
Cheapest thing we could find. That still would run.
And this is going to be presumably to haul the coffee grounds, right? Because you needed
all the coffee waste.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was to pick up the coffee waste. We signed a lease on a 250 square foot.
Mm-hmm.
Office that was supposed to be our warehouse in which we'd cultivate the mushrooms.
We'd wake up early in the morning, meet up at like 5 a.m. And at that point, you know, we ended up meeting with Pete's Coffee, and they came by our spot and we pitched them what we were trying to do, and they helped. They were excited about it.
They said, yeah, you can have our coffee waste. And presumably they were paying somebody to remove their waste, right?
They were. That when we started off, we weren't getting paid. That was a whole separate discussion, actually, a little bit later as we proved ourselves. But to the beginning, it was just like, can we be allowed to go into your back of your cafes and go, you know, pick up your coffee ground waste every morning? And yeah, Pete's Coffee was our first major kind of supply partner.
Yeah, they had a couple hundred coffee shops. And then eventually we went and said, hey, how about paying us?
And they said,
well, at that point, though, we had been collecting coffee grounds for some time, for, you know, probably what, 6, 8, 9 months, I think, consistently, and had proven ourselves. They were like, we were literally replacing waste management in their stores, which was a cost driver for them. And so, like, we ended up negotiating a rate that was a little bit cheaper than I think what they were paying waste management. And so we really became valet waste collectors.
Were you taking the coffee grounds to this 250 foot square foot office space and like filling up buckets in that little office space?
They'd be filled up in bags.
Okay.
And that's right.
And you just would put it on the ground in that off in that warehouse or the office?
We put them on the racks that we bought with the $5,000.
I gotcha. So you would just have racks of bags growing mushrooms. What kind of mushrooms?
Pearl oyster mushrooms.
Yep. Pearl oyster mushrooms, right. And how are you growing these mushrooms?
So the process is you pick up the coffee waste, dry it, put them in the bags, add the mushroom spawn, and then you leave it in a dark room for roughly 2.5-3 weeks. Yep. And then, well, mushrooms are pretty fascinating. They only grow when they think they're going to die. So you have to immediately go from a dark room to a light room. You have to go from a dry room to a really humid room. So with those shocks, mushrooms get scared and they begin to fruit. And that takes about 10 days.
How did you do all of that in a non-climate controlled warehouse or 250 square foot office in Oakland?
We bought some tarp and some humidifiers.
Lots of duct tape.
Humidifiers, okay. Oh, duct tape. So you would just like, you sealed a part of the room off?
Yep.
We've tarped up our humidity chamber and stuck a bunch of humidifiers. This is how we got started off. Fans and removed some of the ceiling tiles to create some more, you know, air exchange. Looking back, it was crazy.
How did you figure out how to do this? Was it all through watching YouTube videos?
And reaching out to experts.
All right. Now you've got a bunch of bags of mushrooms. At what point, I guess, I read it was like October of 2009, is when you finally had enough mushrooms to bring to Whole Foods. How much did they buy?
First invoice was 3.14 pounds.
So they bought 3 pounds of your oyster mushrooms. And what do they pay you?
$10 per pound, which was pretty good price. Very good price.
So $30 and some change. And not bad for 6 months of work.
Not bad at
not
all.
Not bad at all.
We were so happy. We drank a beer at the Berkeley Whole Foods 5 a.m. because you have to deliver early in the morning, and so. But we had the invoice and cheers to a beer that we chugged at 5 a.m. after we sold those.
And how did they market it at the Whole Foods? Did they have like a did it say like locally grown mushrooms and coffee grounds, or did they not do that?
Yeah, they put a little picture.
Oh, they put your picture up?
Yeah, they really told the story. These are grown off of local coffee grounds, and this is grown a mile away almost, literally, you know. It was awesome. The first store, they really got behind it.
I always buy that. Every time I go to Whole Foods, I see that. I always buy that. I'm a sucker for those stories. I love it. So presumably when you sold them those 3 pounds of mushrooms, it was with the understanding that you would sell them more, that you now had an operation and you could provide them with more. Did they say, and now we want 10 pounds a week, or not quite yet?
Yeah, the two things we didn't really consider. One is, well, once you sell it to a store, you've got to make sure it sells through so the buyer sees that the product's selling through. And mushrooms, the shelf life's short, so it's got to sell pretty quickly. And then the other part was that as soon as you sell out, they're going to say, we want more for that store and we want to expand you to another store.
Yeah.
And after that first 3.14 pounds, there was about a month or two that we didn't have much more. We still hadn't consistently produced crops.
Because you would basically plant some spawn and they just wouldn't grow.
Yeah, you'd get trichoderma, like, which is that green fungus. That was a tough time.
Oh, it was the most, disheartening from May through October. You know, you graduate, leave your jobs, you're riding high, and then you plant. We planted our first batches, you know, right late May. 3 weeks of anticipation, excitement. We figured out. And then now you're talking about probably mid-June when the first crop we had planted should have been ready. Nothing. And then we were planting every single day. So then you come back every night, you would come back and just check and check and nothing. And just, you look back and like, that was crazy. Every day waking up at 5, collecting coffee grounds, planting, drying them, just to kind of see nothing.
When we come back in just a moment, Nikhil and Alejandro learn a critical business lesson. It's not always a good idea to take people on a tour of your fungus farm. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2009, and Nikhil and Alejandro are full-time mushroom farmers, selling whatever they can grow to Whole Foods and making extra cash by hauling away used coffee grounds. All good developments, but still, they're barely making any money.
I mean, we were living off of very little. We took, I think, $100 a week each. And, you know, it took us until January, really, to get some consistent crops to Whole Foods. But the beauty about starting a sustainable business in which you're taking waste to produce something is that, yeah, the raw materials are actually not even free. You're making money.
You were paid. Right. That's the brilliance of it, because you were hauling the coffee grounds, which is what you needed to grow your mushrooms. You were paid for that. So you had cash coming in and then selling the mushrooms. So you had some cash flow. You had some money coming in.
Yep. So spawn was really our biggest expense. So we were buying spawn because we were not sophisticated enough to be able to kind of grow our own spawn and seed. But in the scheme of what we were doing, it was a very small percentage. But as we were scaling up growing mushrooms, and we were starting to collect thousands and thousands of pounds of coffee grounds per week, and we were growing mushrooms on them. And what's left over was the spent mushroom substrate, which at the time we kind of knew was something interesting, but didn't know much about it. Ended up kind of stockpiling it.
The substrate is what's left over in the grounds?
Yeah, so it's the mycelium or the roots of the mushroom,
okay,
so to speak.
Yep. Okay.
The white roots grown throughout all the coffee grounds. The mushrooms have fruited or grown off of it. And we were starting stockpiling this behind our warehouse. And I don't think I'd fully thought through what we were doing with this. And I remember actually we got an email from our landlord saying, he's like, this stuff is starting to stink. I've seen rats running through there. You got 2 weeks to get rid of it all. If not, I'm terminating your lease and you guys are kicked out. And we ended up putting it on Craigslist and didn't know what else to do. And honestly, within probably 48 hours, all of it was accounted for.
People wanted it for what?
Urban farms, local gardeners we kind of learned through them that this is one of the most premium, nutritious soil amendments there is, period. And mushroom mycelium, like the mycorrhizae it's called, are actually one of the most beneficial things you can add to your garden because it helps your roots uptake nutrients. So imagine adding plant food, which just is like the actual nutrients. But what mushroom roots or mycorrhizae do is actually help your plants better extract whatever is in your native soil. So really good stuff for your garden.
So you basically had coffee grounds mixed with this mycelium, and that is plant food, basically? You would sprinkle that over your garden?
Exactly. So we started selling that guy, and we sold it actually in bulk. We had now the waste of waste of waste,
wow,
which was all revenue. So imagine, you know, coffee grounds, getting paid for that, growing mushrooms off it, and then our own waste, what we were selling as well. So like, that whole cycle is what allowed us to bootstrap this company when we were getting started.
So in the first half year, at least, it was just the two of you.
Just the two of us. I mean, it was probably 15-hour days between collecting and planting and then harvesting and then demoing at night.
Okay, so at this point, you're selling the mushrooms at Whole Foods, and I think you're doing some farmers markets too at that time. And what kind of reaction were you getting from people? What are people saying to you?
Two, I think, different things were happening at the same time. One, we'd always do farmers markets, and anytime families came by with their kids, they would stay there for half an hour with us. They'd buy a lot more mushrooms. They'd love the story. They'd come and do tours of our farm. And they'd say, hey, can I take one of these bags home? I'll try to grow them out of my kitchen.
So basically, when you refer to your quote-unquote farm, you're literally talking about a warehouse full of bags of mushrooms. It's not like a bucolic farm with like rolling green hills.
No. It was scary. It just looked grindy. We were next to a recording studio and an insurance agency.
Wow.
And it was, to our consumers from farmers market, awesome.
It is awesome.
But to a Whole Foods produce buyer, It was not awesome. And we made the mistake of, just because we were starting to get more confidence with these tours, we're like, hey, produce, you know, team, come and do a tour.
Oh, you invited the Whole Foods team to come and check out your operation?
Yes. And we were so proud.
Yeah.
And right after that, Randy calls us.
The Whole Foods buyer.
And he says, guys, never do that again.
What? Why?
Because he's like, the health aspect of it could turn into something we don't want to go there. Like, just,
it took us like, what, 6 months after that, we had to get certifications because Whole Foods is like, you guys need to do all these health and safety checks. That was our first big kind of regulatory lessons and
scaling up
and selling to a major retailer.
So when you had to, like, kind of quote unquote professionalize it and get it up to code and stuff, I mean, all power to the Bay Area, but I mean, the regulatory regime in the Bay Area can be quite something for anybody who started a business. What did you have to do to get it like kosher, to make it a kosher operation, so to speak?
We would spend hours cleaning. I mean, I remember Alex and I, that, like, we'd just be jamming out to music and wiping the walls every day because you want to keep it pristine, because if not, you know, you might have a competing fungus growing. So we would spend so much of our days those days was just us mopping and scrubbing and cleaning and trying to keep this little space as pristine as we could. And, you know, Whole Foods guided us a lot.
They would help guide you from start to finish.
All right. So now, so you've got the mushrooms, but then around this time, I think late 2009, you decide to kind of make kits, mushroom kits, where people could grow them themselves. First of all, I would just think that would cut into your business, because now you're giving people the means of production. You know, you're not giving them your mushrooms anymore. And now they can make their own mushrooms. So to hell with you guys, why do I need to buy your mushrooms? But that was not the thinking, presumably.
Well, the thinking was that when we had so many families come to do these tours and they could take a souvenir home, that would be at $20. So that same bag would produce roughly $10 worth of product. This now became a $20 product. And that was one part of it. The other part of it was people were sending us pictures by text and email of their fully grown kit. And that was impactful because you now had our consumers come back to us and they became the farmer with us.
And we didn't know this early on, but we kind of learned this through those kind of experiences. The kits weren't about the mushrooms. They were about the experience of growing and just seeing something grow and growing something yourself.
Okay, but to make the kits, right? And for people who aren't familiar with them today, they're like cardboard boxes, and you know, it's got branding on it, and it's a printed package, and there's a bag of soil that has mushroom spawn in it and a booklet on how to grow them. You know, everything's in there, right? But that costs money. It costs money to finance that. So how did you, like, how were you able to launch the mushroom kits, even though I know you had some cash flow, but I can't imagine you had that much cash to work with?
I think Alex and I, early on, tapped into every support avenue there was, and that, you know, we applied to a ton of business plan competitions. We probably, what, got Alex $100,000+ from different winnings. The city of Oakland was incredible, and we moved from Emeryville to Oakland and got about a $25,000 redevelopment grant from them to build out our, what became our largest, you know, warehouse, 10,000 square feet in West Oakland.
And I think you even got a loan from Whole Foods, right?
We got the local producer loan from the Northern California region.
And that loan was to do, what could you do? What'd you do with that loan? It's like $25,000, I read.
One of the best uses of that grant funding, I remember we finally, this was 2 years or so, Alex, into it, maybe more. There was a local machinist near a West Oakland facility, and he would just see us every morning for hours grinding away on this wine press, drying these coffee grounds. And he was like, I think I can make you guys an automated one. And, you know, it cost significant money. It was, you know,
11 grand.
It was 11 grand, yeah. And he ended up building this beautiful automated thing, custom built for us at his machine shop. And I remember vividly the first time that we got this machine, put coffee grounds in there, it took 90 minutes. We hit one button, and 60 seconds later, he had perfectly dried coffee grounds at the right moisture consistency.
Wow.
And it was just this game-changing moment. Never forget that, clicking that button.
I wonder, I mean, you're now a year in, right? You get to the to mid-2010. You've got people now working for. How many people were you able to hire initially in that first year? Do you remember?
Nikhil, I want to say we roughly had 5 people all in.
That's about right, yeah.
And we did 250,000
in year one.
In revenue, year one.
So I wonder in that first, you know, why I mean, it would take a while. We'll get to this later, but it would take a while for you guys to actually go out and raise money. But why didn't you do that early on? Why didn't you go out and look for investors?
We still knew we were figuring all this thing out. Like, there was a lot of moving parts. I mean, we were doing everything ourselves and we were still making a lot of mistakes. And I mean, we would throw away stuff. Like, nobody would invest in a business like that.
And so it wasn't even on your radar?
Not even on our radar. We were all focused on grants, actually. That was all our energy because we knew that we had something that we could see it and feel from customers that they're like, this is so cool. You're taking waste. You're selling the waste. You're selling fresh mushrooms that come from waste. So we felt that always, and that's why we stayed in it.
All right. So you guys, you're selling mushrooms, and I think by year one, you're in all the Whole Foods in Northern California.
Mm-hmm. I mean, 500 pounds a week at $10 and 50 weeks is roughly $250,000. So that was where most of that revenue was coming from.
So your core business was raw mushrooms that people would buy and then cook.
In 2010, our bread and butter was fresh mushrooms.
Okay. And also in 2011, was your bread and butter mushrooms?
2011 got a little bit more from waste collection because we were by then picking up from roughly 40 Pete's and Starbucks and local shops.
Wow. A week?
Yeah, a week.
Because I think 2011, you're basically, your customers are Whole Foods and Pete's, right? Essentially.
That's right. But we were also doing a lot of farmers markets guy at that time too. So that was a lot of, like, Alex and I every weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 10 hours for, you know, years. That's all we did. And that's, you know, the mushroom kits. We started creating mushroom kits. We were first selling them at farmers markets and getting a, you know, great feedback. So, yeah.
And so this is 2011. You've got these the sort of three, let's say, legs of the stool: soil, fresh mushrooms, mushroom kits. Were you just so busy, the two of you and your small staff, that you couldn't really figure out where this was going to go? Or at this point, did the two of you start to have conversations saying, hey, you know, maybe we should kind of assess what we want to do here and where we should focus? Or was it just like, let's just keep doing it this way?
We had gotten our mushroom kits from farmers markets. Then we got them into Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. And Randy was, a mentor of ours. And actually, I remember the first time we took this big like basketball-sized bag that we were growing these mushrooms in, and we had slapped a sticker on it from FedEx. We thought it looked beautiful. We were in a meeting with Randy talking about fresh mushrooms. And at the end of the meeting, we pull out this mushroom kit, you know, with all the confidence in the world, as if it was the next iPhone, right? And we put it on the table. We're like, one more thing, Randy. What about this mushroom kit? And he looks at this bag, and he literally falls out of his chair. He's like, that's the most disgusting thing I've ever seen. No one's going to buy that in my store. And he just, you know, laughed at this thing. But he was also, you know, by that point, a friend, a mentor. And it wasn't a no. He was like, just go back and figure this thing out because it's cool, but this thing looks hideous. No one's going to put this on their windowsill. And it was actually the push that we needed at that time to really kind of make us focus in on the design and the user experience. We came back with what is, you know, a version of what it is today and started selling that in Whole Foods. And we were for a while selling both of them, mushrooms and mushroom kits.
All right. So you guys have this business going, still bootstrapped. And this is a total, like, I'm going to take the off ramp here and go in a totally different direction for everybody. So there's a warning for everybody listening. In May to June of 2012, Alejandro, you become a contestant on the 8th season of The Bachelorette. This is not part of the narrative. This is true. I am not making this up. You leave the mushroom business for some time to be a contestant on The Bachelorette. I need the backstory and the front story and the middle story, please.
Nikhil, the floor is yours.
It was a friend of one of the casting directors for The Bachelorette, I think, had gotten a mushroom kit from Alex and heard about the brand through a demo at an LA Whole Foods. A lot of random things came together where they were like, oh, you should just talk to Alex. And somehow Alex got connected to The Bachelorette casting director, and you know, they loved Alex and thought he'd be a great fit for it. And
they thought he'd be a great fit because, aside from the fact that he's handsome and charming, that there's a great backstory there.
He's a handsome, he's a smart, charming entrepreneur doing cool stuff. And they thought he'd be a great, you know, a great contestant and just who he is.
An urban mushroom farmer.
I gotcha. And Alejandro, did you think, hey, you know, this might be my ticket to meeting my true love?
I was 23. Like so many things, one of their producers was this guy named Elon, and the guy just sold you on the whole experience. And it was, they had announced who the bachelorette was, and that was Emily Maynard. She had a daughter named Ricky. So I was 23, she was 27, 28 with a six-year-old daughter. So it was this thing where just one thing would lead to another, and this, we kind of laughed and just said, what the heck, let's just do it.
It was a big decision. I remember you were basically MIA. Like, we had two phone calls allowed for the 45 days, and yep. It was like Alex chose me. Like, you could have one person you could talk to when you're on this because they don't want anything leaking, so you, right. You know, you can choose somebody. So Alex chose me as this, you know, prison phone call, so to speak. And we got two phone calls over like a month and a half and checking in on the bit. You know, it was a big decision, but we're like, this is a kind of a once in a lifetime thing. Like, who knows where it goes. And
you did not make it. Clearly you were not married to Emily today, so you did not make it all the way to the end.
I did not.
I until the final 8 or 9, Alex? I remember we had a viewing party at our warehouse.
I was the random Hispanic that didn't say a word the entire time. I was so nervous, so quiet.
Did you get recognized ever? People like, hey, Alejandro, I saw you on The Bachelorette.
I was so, I think I had like a one second of local fame.
there was a good year. There was a lot of that, which was fun.
All right. So you, The Bachelorette ends. You're back to work.
Yep.
And you guys are still bootstrapping, but clearly it seems like by 2012, it becomes clear, I think, that the growth part of your business are the kits. Am I right about that? The mushroom kits? Was that growing faster than the mushrooms themselves?
Yeah. You know, at that moment, I think we were kind of realizing they're both pretty different things we were selling. One was more this branded experience that required education and teaching people, like, what is a mushroom kit? What's a grow kit? What is this? I can grow my own food at home. You know, there's a lot of education focused versus selling fresh mushrooms, which was a kind of a different thing, and scaling up that production. And so I think we started realizing there's, you know, we may have to choose one of these things.
And it became so clear that with fresh mushrooms, we could have a local farm, sell locally, get our mushrooms into people's homes locally, or we had this other avenue in which these mushroom kits could be shipped nationwide. And it just was like, let's do the latter, let's do that, and let's put all our energy on that.
When we come back in just a moment, how Alejandro and Nikhil go all in on mushroom kits, and how the decision to expand even further almost wipes them out. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR.
Let's get back to it.
Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's 2012, and Nikhil and Alejandro have decided to focus full-time on making mushroom-growing kits for the home gardener. And they're still providing all the elements required to grow the mushrooms. But then someone suggests that they partner with a specialty farm called Gourmet Mushrooms Incorporated, run by a guy named David Law.
Brilliant. Him and Chris Bailey, the two guys who run that, just brilliant people and best in class at growing fresh mushrooms. You know, it would take us decades to get to the experience these guys had. And we just hit it off also just in a relationship standpoint. And, you know, you fast forward a few weeks and they grew some, and we tested them out, and it was night and day quality. Like, I mean, yields, consistency, everything that goes around making a healthy mushroom substrate and spawn. It was just night and day. And that was probably the biggest defining moment, I think, in our journey earlier for Alex and I both, when you realize, one, you don't have to do everything. It's okay not to be the best at everything. And it's okay to let some things go. And that was the hardest thing to let go, because that was our identity.
Let me understand. When you say let it go, you meet this guy, David Law. Clearly, they know how to grow mushrooms better. So what did you do? I mean, what were you selling to him?
What we were doing in our warehouse in Oakland of collecting the substrate, the coffee grounds, mixing of the spawn, growing the kits, packaging them, we fast forward ended up now buy those from him as a supplier to us. So they're the ones incubating all of that. So
here's
this huge warehouse, 10,000 square feet. You know, we had at that point, 35 people, Alex? You know, we knew what that meant was that the people, the space, everything we're doing, all of that would go away.
So you essentially get out of the farming business at the end of 2012, 2013, you start to transition out of the farming business, because really this company can grow the mushrooms, sell you the ground, whatever's left.
The finished product.
And you can then this guy, David, at this company, Gourmet Mushrooms, they can turn them into kits for you.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy because, he was a competitor to us and he could have easily said, nope, I'll wait till you guys, go out of business because you're not going to be able to scale it the way I can. And instead, David basically looked at us and said, you guys have so much energy and you're getting people growing mushrooms. That's a good thing for me. So let me take it off your plates and you guys focus on what clearly you guys are really good at, which is getting the word out into the world about mushrooms. And that's like the partnership right there.
And so by the middle of 2013, I have to assume you get out of the coffee hauling business. You no longer are hauling away coffee grounds for Pete's.
Correct.
Okay. So you are out of the coffee. It's amazing. I mean, because you start this business in 2009. By 2013, you're no longer, you're two big revenue streams, fresh mushrooms and hauling coffee grounds. You're out of that business entirely. You're focused on selling mushroom kits. And what's interesting to me about that is I cannot imagine seeing a viable business there. Like, I could not imagine in 2013 saying, we're going to sell grow your own mushroom kits and turn this into a sustainable business. So what was giving you the indication that you could do that? I'm not trying to be harsh. I cannot imagine saying to people, we're doing to make your own mushroom. Like,
you know what? The beauty about the United States is if you execute on one thing extremely well, there is a pretty large market for it. I mean, just Whole Foods alone was 500 stores that we could take this product into, and running the numbers on it, you could do a couple $1 million.
Yeah. If you're in every Whole Foods in America selling mushroom kits and you're doing really well, the math suggests that you could probably do like 5, maybe 7 million in revenue maximum a year. So you could do a significant small business for sure. Mm-hmm. But that's only if you did it in Whole Foods, and you'd have to kill it.
That's true. We'd have to sell a lot, and then we'd have to expand beyond Whole Foods.
You're dead on there. I think with the kits, we were starting to also realize this was 2012, I think, Alex, when we did our first non-mushroom product, with our Kickstarter for our water garden. So I think we were, at that point also, we had made this decision. We had started seeing, hey, there's something here,
And at this point, you guys are seeing that people like to grow things at home. And around this time, you wind up getting some inspiration for your next idea from after a visit you take to Wisconsin and a tour of an aquaponics farm there. What's the story?
Yep. It was called Growing Powers. This huge city block-sized aquaponics system. A guy named Will Allen, he won the MacArthur Award for this. He was raising tilapia. So aquaponics is raising fish and plants. All the fish waste was fertilizing the vegetables. The plants, in turn, were cleaning the water and taking out the nitrogen from it. So it's this really cool closed loop system where the fish feed the plants clean the water. And, this is where our own curiosity about just growing food and growing things different ways was like had been peaked now. And, we were obviously doing it with a mushroom farm, but we were like, what else, how else people are growing? And we started like asking ourselves, like, is there a way to do what we did for mushroom farming for aquaponics and like shrink down a big mushroom farm down to this tabletop classroom experience?
And just to be clear, how did you come up with this? Because eventually this is what you would create, basically a fish tank with fish inside, but growing on top is like greens, like microgreens that you could eat and that were fed through the waste of the fish, which we'll get to in a sec. But how did you come up with that idea? How did that come to you?
We, on the side of our mushroom kit facility, we had a bunch of piping and buckets and started kind of building our own and tinkering, and had actually built out a really rough, again, like buckets kind of prototype of like, we had betta fish and had some, the waste from that was enough to grow herbs and microgreens that you could harvest up top. And we were talking to all the aquaponics experts. We actually, funny story guy, we ended up reading the Steve Jobs biography and were super inspired by their design principles, and cold emailed Johnny Ive from Apple and on a Sunday afternoon. And he actually got back to us in like 5 minutes, and we were able to spend a handful of sessions with him kind of mentoring us and showing him prototypes and design things.
Wow.
So it was
amazing.
It was an amazing experience designing this thing.
Wow. You cold emailed Johnny Ive, the guy who designed basically everything we use today. And he was like, yeah, I'll help you with your fish tank.
That was insane.
You know, I will say we learned a lesson here with our mushroom kit. We were anxious doing this all. We were anxious because our brand, who we were, our identity, we'd walk into Whole Foods and it was like, oh, it's the mushroom guys. That's who we were. And now all of a sudden we're experimenting with fish poop and, you know, like microgreens. And so we actually ended up on this product. We put it on Kickstarter, and it was partly to raise funds for it. Mm-hmm. But really, I think it was for the two of us to try to convince ourselves, like, is there something here? And do people actually want this thing? And we put a $100,000 goal up for 30 days, and we ended up hitting $250,000 of pre-orders on Kickstarter and another $250,000 on our website in the following 30 days after close. We had almost $500,000 of pre-orders off of like a three-minute video and a concept. And that's when I think we realized, like, this back to the roots, bigger than mushrooms, it's something else that people wanted to reconnect with food. And I think that month was our proof point.
So with that $500,000 that you raised, it's amazing. You're still bootstrapped at this point. Mm-hmm. You presumably could take that money and start production on these fish bowls or fish tanks that grow that grow salad on top.
I think that was the beauty of Kickstarter, where it was both to raise funds, but to see if anybody would buy this thing. And then if you really made a splash, retailers would eventually, it would get sent to a retailer. So Petco and Whole Foods became the launch partners.
Wow.
And Nordstrom.
Thank you. Yeah.
So here's a business question. You get Nordstrom, Petco, and Whole Foods putting in an order. I have to imagine the costs are going to be higher than $500,000. You probably make them in China, get them shipped over. I mean, there's a lot of math and a lot of like projections that you have to get right to make this work. Even if you have purchase orders, like, it can all go south. So how were you able to successfully manage that?
Two things, Guy. One, just on where the manufacturer, we actually manufacture them all in the U.S.
Okay,
for a brand who we really try to focus on U.S. manufacturing. And a bulk of that, probably half of that, went to the tooling, which is really expensive, and the design cost and engineering cost. So yeah, most of that was there, and then for initial inventory costs. But I think the risk was almost less about the initial forecast because, you know, we had pre-orders, thousands of them, from our consumers through Kickstarter. We had POs from retailers. So we knew what the demand was, but one of our biggest mistakes we made and almost put us out of business was we started feeling a lot of pressure to deliver this on a timeline that was too aggressive, and we didn't know that it was too aggressive when we put it out there on Kickstarter.
We went from, I mean, the definition of 0 to 100. We went from one prototype that we did a video on to a 40,000 unit order. And highly discourage, or do not recommend this to any entrepreneur, to just go from a prototype to 40,000.
And we ended up, I think, looking back, I wish we had just, you know, been transparent and confident, said, hey, we're not going to hit that timeline. Like, please, you know, support us through this and be patient. But we rushed it and we put out a product, our first one that, like, you know, was just, we didn't test it enough. And our first pump was overheating in the unit because of the design constraints. And you know, almost was like 80% of the pumps, Alex, died within the first 30 days of the units going out on Kickstarter. And it was, it literally put us out of business almost.
So how much money did you guys lose?
Oh, I mean, with 80% of those pumps broken.
We caught most of them on the Kickstarter. That was the blessing of the Kickstarter. I think we caught that with those early users, the first 5,000-6,000 people that got it, and we realized that. And so we had to send them all replacements and do the whole, but luckily we were able to, before the Whole Foods and the retail orders went out, make some changes to it last minute. But if that pump had, for instance, taken 2 months to die and not 4 weeks, and so we had already produced stuff for the retailers, oof.
That would, but I would say the economics of it changed. We had to, the pump was significantly more expensive than we thought, and the price point then became off, and we then didn't have a proposition that the company could actually make money sustainably. So we almost went out of business for the entire order. Both Kickstarter led to us still on the nationwide launch was a disaster. We had high return rates. So yeah, that was a tough time. And during that time, we, in isolation, really improved the product and launched a 2.0 version.
So, all right, eventually you get this Aquapharm back, or like you get it in working order. How long did that take you before you were able to say, okay, we got this under control? Was it like weeks, months?
Well, by the way, I'll say I love that you called it the Aquapharm. We actually got sued for calling it the Aquapharm, and we had to go and beg for forgiveness. And said, okay, fine, we won't make you discard all your packaging inventory, just sell it out, but you need to change your name to the Water Garden. So during that crazy messiness, we also got the cease and desist letter at the same time.
I mean, this is the thing. At every stage, and we're now in 2014, you're so vulnerable. Like one lawsuit, you know, because even if the lawsuit was frivolous, you could have spent all your money fighting it. You know, one lawsuit, one mistake, somebody getting sick from a mushroom kit. There could have been, anything could have gone wrong, or a competitor coming in and just crushing you. It just, up to this point, I mean, obviously you guys are smart and you worked, but you guys are kind of lucky up until this point.
We were one bad event from just completely going out of business, pretty much for the first 6 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I look back and maybe the rational thing would be, it's like, hey, not worth the risk. And I keep on going back to just this partnership and the two of us doing it together kind of got us through all these moments, you know. And man, like, you know, we were, when we finally had our own apartments and we're getting some salary, you know, we still carpool in and out every day. You'd pick me up at 6 a.m., drop me off at 8 p.m. and those, you know, every day kind of reset in the morning and night and just refreshing each other's energies and kind of worked our way through it.
So once you got the aquariums up and running, and you know, how did they sell? Did they do pretty well? Were they generating revenue?
Yeah, the Water Garden, that was a really big boost for the company. And I think it first took us from just being the mushroom guys to, hey, there's something really interesting in this, you know, company called Back to the Roots.
And now you're in Petco too, which is great. You're beyond Whole Foods. You're in Petco and Nordstrom.
Beyond Whole Foods, we're selling, you know, in the home department, we're selling in grocery, and now we're selling in the pet department also. At this time, Amazon was really starting to explode. So we put this item on Amazon and it became the number one selling aquarium and stayed that way for quite some time.
You guys, I think by 2014, you started in 2009. By 2014, you had generated $4.6 million in revenue. And I think you were profitable. That same year, this is, again, we're going to go off the freeway here. This is totally like out of left field. You launch a cereal brand. You've gone from mushrooms to salad on top of a fish tank to cereal now.
I think what we started realizing, Guy, with this vision of ultimately what we were doing was trying to reconnect, you know, families and kids to food and where it comes from. it was all a continuum, right? Whether you're from seed and the farmer and growing it yourself, or if you're going to go and buy a prepackaged item that someone grew and cooked and packaged for you, you should still know where it's coming from. And I think being and selling in Whole Foods as well, starting to kind of envision that coming to life through both a ready-to-grow line with our kits and a ready-to-eat line with cereal, and we'd launch snacks as well. So on our cereal, actually, was the first identity preserved, like 100% stone ground, biodynamic cereal. Actually put the ingredients, first brand put the ingredients on the front of the box. And so we're like, whether you're growing yourself or if you're going to buy food from us, you're going to know exactly kind of where it's coming from. And yeah,
I'll say we grew that. And even just the not so crazy part of it was we were selling to Whole Foods already nationwide.
Yeah. So you already had a connection there.
Yeah. And on top of that, we were working with schools nonstop with all our kits. So many teachers were our consumers. So it was natural for us to basically sell, well, let's go out to the biggest, most impactful school district in the entire country. So we went out to New York Public School District and said, hey, as we launch and expand immediately nationwide with Whole Foods Market, let's put this in the communities that needed the most through purchase orders that they would place. And we did that. We launched in New York Public Schools, which was it was 2,000 schools that started serving an organic and biodynamic cereal. It had 1/5 of the sugar with 3 ingredients.
Just to be clear, you did not build a factory to make the cereal, right? You worked with like a co-packer or a different manufacturer?
Yep. We worked with a co-manufacturer and co-packer in making the product, yep.
In January of 2016, you raised your first round of funding. This is now, what, 6 years, 6+ years since you founded the company. You go for funding. I have to imagine it wasn't that hard to raise money. You raised $5 million because you had a track record. Am I right about that, that it wasn't that hard?
Every financing round, I would say, is hard.
Yeah.
We did like a $2 million round from angel yep. investors. And then after that, we did a $10 million round, and that one came from Acre Ventures.
So you start to raise money. I think up to today, you've raised almost $25 million in outside investment. I think that's right, more or less, right? Something like that?
Yeah. By the time this airs, it'll be $40
million. So my question is, when did you decide that you were a gardening company? Because you started out as the mushroom guys and then the fish tank guys and the cereal guys. When did it become clear that actually you are a gardening company? Because that's how you describe yourself now. So when did that kind of all gel?
We had great revenue growth, really great revenue growth, but we were just not able to be profitable on the cereal and snack side at the moment. And there was no clear path unless we went and purchased our own equipment and fully vertically integrated, which would have been significant risk to the business. And on the other side, the lawn and garden business was already profitable. And what's interesting is I think first being able to focus just on the lawn and garden piece of our business was like so energizing. And I think we ourselves were so focused on, you know, growing within Whole Foods that it almost crippled our ability to take a step back and say, where are our consumers actually shopping? And we realized, wow, our consumer gardeners, they're going to the Home Depot, they're going to Lowe's, they're going to Walmart, they're going to Target. They're not necessarily going to a produce department at a Whole Foods Market. And I think that ability to focus, and this is something actually Sir Johnny Ive said to us. He said the number one lesson I learned from Steve Jobs was focus. And Steve's definition was focus is the ability to say no to the things you really want to do. And I feel like that just singular focus on like our consumer is a gardener. They're going into home centers on the weekend to pick up their gardening stuff. That's where we need to be. And there's probably 2 years, guy, in our business that we just completely exploded from doing a lot less things.
What did you cut out? And I mean, you said you do fewer things, but you grew.
oh, we were going from Petco. Yeah, we were selling into Petco. We were selling into Whole Foods. We were selling into Nordstrom, you know, online. We were selling to local grocery stores through distributors, UNFI, Kehe. Yeah. Like, we just had, and it's a small team. And I think once we just realized, like, gardeners are shopping
at Home Depot.
At Home Depot. The gardeners are, yeah, that's where they're going. Why are we spending all this energy and time trying to find them elsewhere? Let's go fishing where the fish are. So the difference is the Home Depot has 2,000 stores, unlike Whole Foods has maybe 400 stores. So, I mean, this is an order of magnitude also of scale.
So, I mean, that was a game changer, right? When you get into Home Depot. And today, I mean, you sell seeds and you sell grow kits and, you know, you still have the water gardens and raised beds and planters and windowsill planters. I have to imagine this is a growing market, right? From what I gather, this is like a, how big is the home, the edible gardening market?
It's about $20 billion. And by the way, Scotts Miracle-Gro being the category captain, they're about a $12 billion market cap company. So you've got a lot. It's a big market. It's America's number one hobby is gardening. It's traditionally been to the older generation. The average gardener today is 59 years old. Our average gardener is 29 years old. So you do have this pretty massive gap from what the average gardener is in America to back to the roots average gardener.
But we, you know, whether it's an 8-year-old or a 68-year-old can both enjoy the brand and maybe have a smile on their faces for different reasons. But like, how do we be a spark of curiosity for a new generation? We're not telling people like grow all your own food, or we don't want to come here and say we're going to solve all the world's food shortages. We just want to be that spark of curiosity. And I think in so many ways, like, that was just how we started this company. It was just, we were curious, but you kind of distill that all down. And we do this sometimes just as a team. And I don't know, the words that come out of it are just joy and connection.
When you think about this journey and the fact that it really began with a professor saying, hey, you know, grow mushrooms on coffee grounds. And then here you are, 12 years plus later, you know, with a business, I think, that's doing, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars in revenue a year. How much of that do you guys attribute to luck, and how much do you attribute to how hard you worked?
My grandpa was very close to. He told me all the time, he says, the harder you work, the luckier you get. So, you know, every one of those moments you can look at, you know, I guess it was lucky that 1 out of 10 grew, but I'm glad we said, let's not just plant one bucket, let's take the time and collect enough for 10 buckets. And I do believe it's both, but I think half of it is, so much of it is staying in the game, staying in the arena for opportunities to present themselves and then being prepared to walk through them.
Guy, we presented to Costco's lawn and garden department 7 years in a row and got turned down every single year. They've just announced they're launching us this coming spring, spring 2022. 7 years later, same exact merchant as well. And then Walmart presented for 4 or so years. And then within 2 years, we are the fastest growing garden brand in their entire department. That took four years to even get in the door. So Nikhil, you're spot on too, man. We've just not given up. And then staying long enough to where luck catches up to you.
That's Nikhil Arora and Alejandro Velez, co-founders and co-CEOs of Back to the Roots. By the way, the company has something called a Grow One, Give One campaign, where if you post a photo of what you grew with one of their kits, they'll donate another to the school of your choice. By the end of this year, they hope to reach 130,000 kids in underfunded schools across the country. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you don't yet follow the show, please do follow wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to write to us, our email address is hibt@npr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're at How I Built This, or mine is at Guy Raz. You can find us on Instagram at How I Built This NPR, or me at Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and Farah Safari, with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. It was edited by Neva Grant, with research help from Claire Murashima. Our production staff includes Casey Herman, J.C. Howard, Julia Carney, Harrison, B.J. Choi, and Elaine Coates. Our intern is Catherine Seifer. And Jeff Rogers is our executive producer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.